The climate is changing. So are we. I'm Laura Lynch, and I host What on Earth? That's CBC's Climate Solutions podcast. Twice a week, we take you around the world to find the people who are trying to build a better future for all of us. We explore indigenous science, new technologies. We talk openly about mental health and climate anxiety. We also take your smart questions all the time. Come find What on Earth wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Those coastal communities are at risk, especially on the west coast of Vancouver Island, because there's not as much time between the earthquake occurring and the tsunami hitting shore.
Anything that can fail will totally fail. And that's where certain buildings that are very vulnerable could potentially collapse.
We'll have potentially traffic accidents, landslides, building collapses, flooding potentially, hazardous materials. Our focus for the safety and of lives now has to take into consideration we have to act on this quicker rather than later.
It's been 72 hours since the earthquake, 3 days of surviving on your own. This is what you've been told to prepare for. You've been told to have enough food and water and supplies to get you to this point. 3 days worth of supplies to get you through an earthquake, an ice storm, a hurricane, or any other catastrophic event. But is it enough? This is CBC Vancouver's Fault Lines, Episode 3, 72 hours after the earthquake, when supplies have run out. I'm Johanna Wagstaff, CBC's seismologist, and I'm your guide as we map the aftermath of a major earthquake here on BC's southwest coast. In the last episode, we took you through the chaos of the first 24 hours. We're now 72 hours in. Our cities and towns are a mess. Entire communities have been cut off. There's still no power, no water, no sewage. We don't know if our homes are safe enough to return to, so we're camped out in backyards and parks. And those few of us who do have earthquake kits are quickly running out of supplies. Emergency officials are struggling to get a handle on the situation in the hardest hit areas. And while first responders are finally getting into those areas, what they're facing is daunting, especially as time is running out for survivors who are trapped or grievously injured. Joe Foster is the Assistant Chief for Vancouver Fire and Rescue Services and manager of Canada Task Force 1, or HUSAR. He and his lieutenant, Eric Barron, are among those searching for survivors.
This is a BC Transit bus under here. And this is just a collapse of a bunch of stuff. It looks like a giant junk heap. Nothing is going to be safe in that environment.
I've met Joe and Eric at their training facility in East Vancouver, and we're standing before an enormous pile of rubble. This is where first responders practice pulling people out of collapsed buildings and parkades, people who are trapped by live wires, gas fires, crushed vehicles, people who are clinging to life after 3 days of waiting for help.
Because it might not be horizontal all the time, there's two different kinds of breaches that they do. They do what would be called a dirty breach, where they've already put a camera down, they know that there's no patient right below here, but they need to get over there very quickly, so they'll do a dirty breach. It's very quick, you cut and you let it drop to the bottom. But if there's a patient down there, you can't come in the sides, you can't come in this way, you got to go in through there. And now you've got to capture that big piece of concrete without it dropping on the patient. And it puts a lot of pressure on the rescuers to make sure they do everything absolutely critical to make sure that that doesn't drop on the patient. That's reality.
Any parking garage or any building in the downtown area is very similar to this in a parking garage, right? So they would actually have to go through the floor above to get to the floor below, and if there's victims below, you'll have to be able to do it cleanly, right? And then you'll see they've gone and, you know, did a little bit of shoring. So to try and bang those nails and put that stuff together in a tight, confined space like that is incredibly hard to do, right? They have to pre-build half of it outside, so your measurements have to be bang on. Then you have to get in and put it in place, and you have to do it all the time to be fast at it.
It's taken a while to get communications back online, but first responders like Joe and Eric are now able to talk to logistics teams back at the emergency command centers. Amateur ham radio operators have been a vital link through these first 3 days, sharing crucial information about damage with emergency officials. The Canadian Broadcasting Corporation is also a lifeline. For some, it's the only connection. Who has survived? How many are lost? In the first few hours, Toronto took on the responsibility of broadcasting what little information was available to the rest of the country, the rest of the world. Now, 72 hours later, a team is working out of CBC Vancouver.
It was just unimaginable what we saw. Being in touch and contact with everyone.
Backup generators are running, and while damage is still too severe to get TV going, our radio, social media, and web teams are doing what they can to make sense of the chaos. We're in communications with Emergency Management BC, passing on information about what infrastructure has been destroyed, which bridges and airports are still closed, where fires are still burning. We're also getting updates on the emergency response and the latest on where you can go for help and supplies. And by now, the focus is shifting towards trying to move supplies into the region because supplies are running out. What food was left on our shelves is now spoiling or was destroyed in the earthquake. It's something that haunts Heather Lyle, the executive director of Emergency Management BC.
I mean, you probably go shopping to Costco, and I'm not sure if you've ever walked through Costco, just look at those reams of big stacks. It's always my greatest worry is I'm going to be in a Costco when the earthquake strikes, because I know that they've done as much as they can to prevent and mitigate those big shelves. But if you were to stop to think about if that's all the food supply that we have is what's currently on the shelves in Costco, it's not going to take long to even exhaust those resources. They say that most of our food suppliers, as an example, have somewhere between 3 to 5 days worth of supplies. So if our transportation routes are impacted, impacting the ability for those trucks who normally bring the resources in to replenish, it's going to take some time for us to figure out how to reroute, how to restage, but still making sure that we're getting those food supplies, not only for the economic factor, but for our own survival, to make sure that we've all got enough supplies to see us through this emergency event until systems are back to some sense of normality.
Moving supplies after a disaster is particularly challenging here in BC. Given our topography, we have few roads in and out, so we rely on our ports, our rail lines, our runways, our bridges, all of which may be damaged or destroyed. Our island communities are cut off, as is the North Shore, which is why the onus will be on us as individuals, on you, in the earliest days. Dorit Mason is the director of North Shore Emergency Management.
Well, if we look at the food availability in all of Metro Vancouver, there's only about 72 hours worth of food for the general public, for anyone. And so that comes back to personal preparedness, because until the logistics are able to move those supplies, then certainly we may run out of food.
So that's a major focus now, getting supplies to areas that need it the most. And not just food, moving water, fuel, and medical supplies. These are also priorities. Richmond spokesperson Ted Townsend is more optimistic than most emergency planners in the region.
We believe that we should be able to move things in and out of Richmond in a major emergency. There may be some disruptions, and it might mean we can't guarantee that we'll have access to every bridge, but we expect that at least some of the bridges would be open and that we would be able to move people and goods in and out of Richmond as necessary.
But while some bridges will be standing, the on-ramps are a vulnerability. And if they're damaged, it doesn't matter how secure your bridge is, you're not getting on it. As for the airport, the air traffic control tower at YVR has been built to post-disaster standard, so it's sustained little damage. But many of the runways are too buckled to land. So the giant Hercs carrying first response and humanitarian teams from outside the province are landing at Abbotsford. Those who were awaiting flights when the earthquake hit are okay, for now, as YVR has a dedicated team of engineers and enough emergency supplies to keep everyone watered and fed for at least a week. Seattle has been hit just as hard as Vancouver, so help is not coming from the south, at least not yet. But coordination across the border is ramping up. Over on the North Shore, Dorit Mason tells me that planners are taking the possibility of being cut off seriously.
We have been working with other municipalities to do communications tests across the water, and we would be activating the disaster response routes, and it's not just by road, it could be by water or air or by rail. And an example of having the air component activated was when we had the landslide on the Sea to Sky Highway just before the Olympics. We ended up having helicopters moving some personnel back and forth. So there we already practiced it.
We're talking a massive operation to mobilize any and all vehicles, not only to move supplies around, but to move medical care around too. While logistics teams are working on getting supplies and personnel moving, life-saving efforts continue. Efforts that are becoming increasingly urgent. Back at the rubble pile with Hussar team member Eric Barron, I'm learning just how tough it can be for first responders that are up against a very unforgiving clock. And how does it work? So you've got one guy being assessed, or one team member being assessed, and are they yelling out to the rest of the team, pass me the concrete saw, oh, now I need a metal saw.
It's a multidisciplinary team, but the fire department generally does the rescue. So they'll have two people in plus a safety officer, and they'll have two people on standby ready to help them if they get in trouble, and then they just keep rotating through. And then as they rotate through, they'll ask for tools or pass other tools out. Okay, this first option worked really well. At the second place, I'm afraid this tool is broken. We take it away from them, and now you have to fall into your backup option, you know, to get part of that breakdown of being able to, okay, this didn't work, here's my second option. Okay, second option didn't work, here's my third option. Okay, no, that's not safe anymore. You know, now you have to approach it from a whole nother area, right?
And it's not just collapsed structures that pose a risk. All those high wire power lines that connect our cities, they're down and they're dangerous.
This is a no-go zone. Right, you know, there's damaged electricity, the step potential, the chances of being hurt, incredibly high. So if you were trapped in behind this, nobody is coming in to get you. If you could self-rescue that person by talking them into walking around it and get out, that's what they're trained to do, rather than put themselves in harm's way. And as you go around the corner, you'll see another part where there was a natural gas prop set up, where they're trained how to turn off the natural gas to a building or to a house. And a little bit farther beyond that, you'll see there's a burn prop where they're trained to use fire extinguishers to extinguish small fires if they can do it safely.
While first response teams are working around the clock to get to and treat the injured, Hussar manager Joe Foster says they're also trying to find a certain balance.
It takes a lot of logistics to get the right amount of equipment and the right amount of trained staff at a local scene, and to be self-sufficient and not be a drain on that community at the same time.
First responders aren't the only ones who should be thinking about the importance of being self-sufficient.
What we haven't quite hit it all the way out of the park on is the community. I think statistically, I'm not sure where it sits, but I don't think it's 50% yet have their own emergency kit ready. I'd be surprised if it was over 25%, which is sad to say, because they're going to be the drain on the first responders when it really should be someone in greater need than someone who could have taken care of themselves today for tomorrow.
This is a particularly important point for people who live in BC's more remote coastal communities. Tofino has been devastated, not only by the earthquake, but by the tsunami that followed. People are still missing. Families separated, unable to communicate, and unsure of who survived and who hasn't. But the community is coming together, as Mayor Josie Osborne expected it would.
At home, having things like tents and sleeping bags and mats and things like that, I want to know that I'm able to take care of myself and my family in those immediate hours and days afterwards. I live right on the very edge, so I know that if I was at home, I would run across the highway to my neighbor's house, and she lives on the high top of a rocky knoll. She knows that I would come over, or that many of her neighbors probably would end up coming over. And that's another really important part of preparedness, which is having a neighborhood plan. First and foremost, I really do feel that we need to be resilient as a community ourselves and literally not rely on any outside agency for days to weeks afterwards. What happens afterwards? Well, honestly, I just hope we make it to that point of needing more resources from a place like the province or the federal government, because then we know we'll be lucky to have survived it.
Aaron Rogers is the manager of community sustainability for the District of Tofino. He feels responsible for his community's safety, and he was prepared for this.
Our family has all of our camping gear. We keep it in our shed outside with 20 liters pails full of rice and beans, plus canned goods. I have a 72-hour kit to my car. So our idea would be to get outside and set up our tents and get some food going. Our house, we live downtown, so we're in the high ground. In the previous evacuations, many of our friends end up with us. So if you're a local person, instead of going to the emergency social services building like you would if you were a tourist, we find a lot of people taking care of their neighbors.
They're able to do that because they had plans in place, both personal and neighborhood plans. Keith Orsheson is the emergency planner for the district of Tofino.
And we thought that putting a group together, there's about 10 of us, a neighborhood emergency preparedness program, coming together as a neighborhood is your first line of defense when there is some sort of major disaster that's happened. Some people have, you know, four kids in our neighborhood, and what would it look like to evacuate with four kids in the middle of the night?
Whether we've got a neighborhood plan or not, 72 hours into this disaster, many of us are now sleeping in parks or on sports fields, too unnerved by the continuing aftershocks to feel safe in our own homes. And as we wait for outside help to reach us, we're coming together as a community. Someone has a satellite phone and is helping others track down family. A man with medical training is making splints, tending to wounds. A teenager with a football has organized a game of catch to distract the younger kids. A couple with a solar panel is keeping the radio going for updates. When the earthquake struck, those who were trapped by debris while at work or out running errands or catching up with friends over a meal, they're all finally making their way home. And so this community of survivors continues to grow. A group is headed out with a list of missing people and questions about things like when the water might start running or the toilets might start flushing. And after 3 days, they've also got some ideas about what they can do to help with the recovery efforts. They're hoping to find all that information in one place, their local emergency center, their community hub. For emergency planners in Vancouver, this hub is key. Daniel Stevens is the Director of Emergency Management for the City of Vancouver.
The community response effort really comes out, but one thing we hear time and time again, and has been reflected in after-action reports, is the sort of ad hoc nature of this has its benefit, but it also has its drawbacks in that some of these groups don't know what the other groups are doing. They're not really linking in with the broader community, and there's no way for them to link in with government. So Christchurch said, the city council said, well, we could have given you guys a bunch of shovels after knowing that, you know, the after-action process that they needed shovels. So these hubs are a way to get the community to be able to rally around a physical location that's close enough to their neighborhood, but not too many of them that it's hard to manage. And it's to allow these community groups to come together. And the concept of smart people coming together can do great things. You know, you just need the right people in the same place.
In addition to the community hubs, some municipalities also keep backup emergency supplies in shipping containers scattered around the city for first responders and emergency planners. And in fact, these shipping containers may become the community hubs themselves. And when you overlay these supply depots with the many fire halls and police stations and hospitals, cities like Vancouver are actually covered pretty well. If, of course, the facilities make it through the earthquake. While Emergency Management BC is coordinating with municipal emergency centers, there's another agency doing the same thing for the health system. John Lavery is the Executive Director of Health Emergency Management BC, and he tells me that in times of disaster, agreements between provinces and teams just south of the border kick in to ensure everyone is getting the medical aid they need, including mental health care. For that, his agency relies heavily on its volunteer psychosocial team.
There's psychologists and there's social workers and police victim services, and there are some other professions in there as well. So if there is an event occurring in the Lower Mainland, we would first of all reach out across our network, and they would be brought in as we are able to provide support to those that are impacted.
But 3 days in, those firefighters, police officers, doctors, nurses, search and rescue volunteers that have been working around the clock, they're exhausted. Mentally, physically, emotionally, but help from the outside is on the way. Doug Smith knows the drill well. An engineer by trade and a longtime search and rescue volunteer, Doug traveled to Taiwan after the earthquake there in 1999. He also went to New York City after 9/11, to New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina in 2005. And here in Canada, he's responded to fires, landslides, floods, you name it. And he says that while some first response teams can be on the ground within 24 hours, there's a reason it can take some time for teams from outside the province to mobilize.
Getting the permission to go, because it's an international event, you have to involve multiple levels of government. So it's the Vancouver city government, it's the provincial government, and it's the provincial government, and it's the government in the country you're going to. You can't just show up at someone's doorstep and knock on the door and say, I'm here to help. So you have to go through the typical bureaucracy to get those approvals. Once those are in place, we're pretty good at the logistical part as far as our trains. To load up all of our equipment onto pallets. Everything is pre-weighed. We practice actually loading and unloading it into airplanes. That's part of the training we do. And even when we went to New Orleans, we stayed up all night putting our cash together, drove out to the airport, and then hand-loaded all of our equipment onto a chartered airplane that was provided for us.
And once those first responders are on the ground?
The most important piece is ensuring that the local authority knows you're there and you're just a tool or a task force for them to use. So they point you in the direction they want you to go, and you go, and whether you're doing search or whether you're actually doing recon or rescue will be up to the authority, and then you just provide your expertise.
We hear this time and time again. Coordination is critical. Out of province, even out of community, teams need to know the rules. They need to know who the local leaders are, who has what resources, who needs support, how to access sites that might be off limits. So while it's great that all these levels of government are working on plans and that humanitarian workers are ready to jump in, if they haven't got that coordination piece, it's going to be that much more difficult to get help to where it's needed. And that's going to lead to more casualties. Sean Carby is manager of protective services with the Capital Regional District on Vancouver Island. It's grim, I know. But when we meet in Victoria, I ask him if there's a plan for what to do with the bodies of those who have been killed in the earthquake or died waiting for help. He told me there is.
I hate to say it, but the dealing with the dead is a lot easier than dealing with those that need higher levels of care. So how do we move those people to care? How do we get care to them? What happens if we find out that during this event that a large number of our healthcare practitioners, our providers, our physicians, our nurses, our lab techs, our pharmacists, our physiotherapists, the people that we rely on every day, what if they're part of their victims as well?
These are the questions that keep Sean Carby up at night. But technology, he says, is helping. From personal water purification straws to innovative shelters for displaced people, designers and engineers are helping to improve our chances with every new disaster. Social media is also a lifeline. As cell coverage comes back online, people are checking in on Facebook, connecting with loved ones, and learning crucial information about what's happened to their community and what to expect in the coming days and weeks. They're sharing updates about their own situations as well, and all of this information is being monitored by comms teams at emergency command centers, and it's helping them to understand exactly what's happened and what kind of shape people are in. It's also helping to fill in their maps. Maps are crucial at this stage. Every single emergency center we visited was built around giant maps. They tell emergency planners what neighborhoods have been destroyed, which fires are still burning, which gas lines have ruptured. They show docks that are of no use, breaks in the rail line. They show where teams on the ground have been and where they still have to go. Drones can help with this. They can spot people who are trapped. They can offer first responders a view of what's on the other side of that mudslide. And as the drones are beginning to send back aerials of the hardest hit areas, we're beginning to understand the bigger picture. And we see that it's not the collapsed buildings we have to worry about now. It's the tens of thousands of people who are now living on the street. As the third day comes to an end, as families are reuniting and the rescue effort is transitioning into a recovery effort, one thing is becoming very clear. Here's Sean Carby again.
I recognize if the impact has damaged infrastructure, and has damaged roads, and has damaged our ability to function effectively, that it may take longer than 72 hours before you can see service in some areas. So on Vancouver Island, we tend to say, yes, 72 hours sounds good for the mainland, but recognize that 80% of our food on Vancouver Island comes from off of Vancouver Island, so it could be lost fairly readily. So the ability for us to have rebound services is pretty slim. So we suggest you prepare for a week, just to be realistic.
But the biggest threat is the displacement of British Columbians. Remember Ted Townsend in Richmond talking about building codes?
Most of our building stock has been built under modern seismic standards, and particularly in Richmond, we spend a lot of time on compacting and stabilizing soil before we build on it.
Well, turns out our building codes only ensure we get out alive, not that our buildings remain habitable. So teams of engineers are now spreading out across the affected zones with green, yellow, and red tags in hand. Will you make it back into your home? On our next episode, 1 week has passed. Tens of thousands of people have been displaced from their homes. Some communities are still cut off, and reality is setting in. Life for every single person living in the Pacific Northwest will never be the same. But we're all in this together. I'm seismologist Johanna Wagstaff. For CBC Vancouver's Fault Lines, a podcast about what we will do to survive when a massive earthquake strikes. For more episodes of Fault Lines, visit cbc.ca/podcasts, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like the show, please share your thoughts by writing us a review.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.